There's new guidance today from the Institute of Medicine on use of a popular nutritional supplement, vitamin D. Vitamin D has been flying off the shelves in the past several years, thanks to doctors' warnings that we're all vitamin D deficient. Well, now comes news that we are consuming too much vitamin D and too much calcium in supplements.
If it all sounds confusing to you, it was also a surprising conclusion for Dr. Clifford Rosen. He was on an independent panel of medical researchers that determined the vitamin D craze has gone a bit too far. And he's with us in the studio now. Dr. Rosen, first of all, it has been practically an article of faith that most Americans don't have high enough vitamin D levels in their blood. That's not true, you say?
We don't think that's true. That certainly was an article of faith, and many of us believed it. I certainly did coming into the Institute of Medicine committee. I published studies showing low vitamin D in Maine women, particularly during the winter months. So I was relatively convinced and was supporting vitamin D supplementation.
Now, some doctors recommend an average of 1,000 up to 3,000 units per day. Your panel recommends 600 units per day. Per adult. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, we looked at what the dietary intake, and this was both Canada and the United States, so this was a joint effort.
And this was a panel convened and at the request of the U.S. government.
That's right. And the Canadian government. It should be remembered that this is for North America. So all of us had this consensus that we needed to make recommendations. And what we had recommended was 600 units of vitamin D and about 1,000 milligrams of calcium. How we got there was by first looking at what dietary intake of vitamin D and calcium was in this country and in Canada. And much to our surprise, people are consuming adequate amounts of both calcium and vitamin D.
Because it's added to so much of our food?
That's exactly right. Mm. We were really surprised. I certainly was very surprised by this.
These two supplements are often recommended together because of bone health.
Right. That's correct.
Dr. Rosen, I remember an article over the summer in the New York Times, and it was about how most of us are vitamin deficient, that the average person should have about 30 nanograms of vitamin D for every milliliter of blood. It included recommendations to spend at least 5 to 10 minutes in the sunshine without sunscreen 3 times a week. And I must confess, I started to do that almost immediately after reading the article. Those recommendations came from Dr. Michael Hollick at Boston University. You're now saying all that is unnecessary. What are the rest of us to make of these different recommendations? I mean, it's very confusing.
It is confusing, and Michael is a good friend of mine and a colleague and mentored me in my early stages of my career, and he's done a lot for the vitamin D field, and he's really brought it to the attention of both bone health experts and also others. So I would just argue that I think we found that 20 nanograms per ml was very sufficient to maintain skeletal health. And indeed, more is not better. And we found no evidence that vitamin D had effects on other disease states.
Like cancer
or heart disease or neurological diseases or multiple sclerosis. When we started the report, we had over 30 disorders from autism all the way to multiple sclerosis that we were looking at to see if there were associations.
Well, what's the downside of taking too much?
Well, that's what got us a little worried. As we got into the report, we actually saw that when levels of vitamin D got too excessive, not only was a blood calcium increase, but we started to see a signal that suggested you might be at increased risk for other diseases, including, surprisingly enough, fractures.
So don't take 5,000 units of vitamin D a day. That's your recommendation.
That's definitely our recommendation.
Which is available.
5,000, sometimes more. And many people are taking them. I practice medicine. I'm a referral for lots of doctors to look at their bones of their patients. And many, many, many people are taking vitamin D supplements.
That's Clifford Rosen. He's a bone specialist at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute and a member of the panel that set new recommendations for vitamin D and calcium intakes. Dr. Rosen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Guy.
Today's last word in business is Element Survival Coat. That's the name of a product developed for consumers who don't have a lot of money to pay.
The coat is the creation of a college student in Detroit, Veronica Scott, who wants to keep homeless people warm on winter nights by passing out copies of her design.
It's made out of Tyvek, which is housing insulation, and either recycled wool or any sort of synthetic fiber.
Scott is 21 years old. She's a design student. She spent time with homeless people in some of the city's toughest neighborhoods.
And I noticed a lot of playgrounds and abandoned homes covered in clothing, in tarps and stuff, made into makeshift homes.
So she designed a coat that doubles as a sleeping bag. The CEO of the outerwear company Carhartt was so impressed that he gave Scott money, material, and industrial sewing machines. She plans to produce the coats locally, possibly using the labor of homeless people. If you want to see a photo of the Tyvek coat, find a link on Twitter at NPR Inskeep. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The nation's largest school system is getting a new leader, the chairwoman of Hearst Magazine's Kathy Black. She will become chancellor of New York City's public schools after weeks of controversy over her qualifications. Much of that controversy swirls around the fact that Black has had a long career in publishing, but she's never worked in education, nor had much contact with public schools. As Beth Furtig of member station WNYC reports, Mayor Michael Bloomberg got the person he wanted, but at some cost to his reputation.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg is fond of telling the public that he's the one accountable for the city schools. But when Bloomberg named 66-year-old publishing executive Kathy Black to replace outgoing Chancellor Joel Klein a few weeks ago, the move still took the city by surprise. Bloomberg apparently considered no one else for the position. Parents and politicians questioned putting someone with no experience in education in charge of a system of more than a million students. Bloomberg argued that given the sheer size of the school system and the prospect of more budget cuts, a professional manager would be most qualified. And on Monday, the mayor finally prevailed, but only after the state education commissioner forced him to hire a chief academic officer to work alongside Black. Bloomberg needed a waiver from a state requirement that school leaders have certain credentials. If installing an educator was a compromise, though, the headstrong mayor didn't see it that way.
There will be one person in charge, make no mistake about that.
But the fact that Black's appointment caused so much trouble shows how a mayor who made billions from his media company isn't always successful in winning public approval. More than 13,000 people signed an online petition opposing Black as chancellor. Justin Wiedes, a former teacher, collected those names and delivered them to the state education commissioner.
And this is not an attack against Kathy Black. She may be a wonderful person. Unfortunately, we haven't heard much from her. We'd like to. But the fact of the matter is that there are plenty of educators who are also excellent managers already in our city, and the job should go to one of them.
A recent poll found more than half of city voters didn't think Black had the right experience to be chancellor. That figure was significantly higher among parents of public school children. With the issue resolved, the mayor said it's time to put politics aside in the interest of children. But that might not be so easy, says Joyce Pernick, a former New York Times columnist who wrote a book about Bloomberg called Money, Power, and Politics.
I think he ultimately got what he wanted, so I'd have to call it a win, but he lost some credibility. He was embarrassed, and I think that his reputation for being out of touch and being an elitist was reinforced by the way he handled this.
And while Bloomberg got his choice of chancellor, his education record is still the subject of great debate. High school graduation rates did increase, as did scores on state math and reading tests, but the pass rate on those tests fell tremendously this year after the state raised the bar, acknowledging its exams had gotten too easy. That all happened under the leadership of departing Chancellor Joel Klein, a lawyer who also needed a state waiver because of his slim experience in education. With Klein moving on after 8 years, Bloomberg's new chancellor has a tough sell. Now that she's convinced the state to give her a chance, she'll have to convince the public that she's right for the job. She takes over in January. For NPR News, I'm Beth Furtig in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. 175 years ago today, Samuel Clemens was born. He's better known to readers as Mark Twain. This year also marks the 125th anniversary of the publication of his masterpiece, Huckleberry Finn. That book, like much of Twain's best work, focuses on life along the Mississippi River. But as Tom Vitale reports, it was largely written far from the Mississippi in upstate New York.
In 1874, Mark Twain's sister-in-law, Susan Crane, built him a writing cottage on Quarry Farm, her summer home in Elmira, New York. Today, the farm is a residence for visiting scholars, run by the Center for Mark Twain Studies at Elmira College. The center's director, Barb Snedeker, says Twain followed the same writing routine here for 20 summers.
Every morning after breakfast, he'd trudge across this front lawn, just as we're doing now, heading over to the stone steps that Susan Crane placed in the hillside. The smell of the woods and the birds and just the beautiful foliage, that was part of what he knew and loved.
When he got to the top of that hill, 100 yards above the house, Twain went into his study and wrote from 8:30 in the morning until 5 in the evening without a break. Quarry Farm overlooks the dairy country of the Chemung River Valley in the Finger Lakes district of western New York. In his letters, Twain called the farm the quietest of all quiet places. He described the view as an elevation that commands leagues of valley and city and retreating ranges of distant blue hills.
And most Mark Twain biographers think that Samuel Clemens, enjoying the beautiful view, the peace and tranquility, and looking at that river, that helped him remember his boyhood in Missouri along the Mississippi River.
The books Twain wrote in Elmira are among the most beloved in American literature, including The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Life on the Mississippi, The Prince and the Pauper, and Huckleberry Finn, performed here by Hal Holbrook.
Jim and me, we found empty section of log raft. We went off down that river together. We run nights and laid up and hid daytimes. We just let that raft float wherever the current wanted it to.
Twain first came to Elmira in 1868 to court Olivia Langdon, the daughter of the richest man in town. Twain was already the well-known author of a book of travel writing, The Innocents Abroad, but had yet to begin his novels. Twain and Olivia were married in 1870, had 4 children, and settled in a mansion in Hartford, Connecticut. But it was during the family's summers in Elmira that Twain did most of his writing. Michael Kiskis is a Twain scholar who teaches at Elmira College.
One thing about Clemens is he was always writing. But Elmira Quarry Farm gave him the separation from business deals, from publishing worries, that allowed him to focus his time and attention in a way that he could not do, I think, in Hartford.
The little study where Twain wrote, 12 feet across with 8 sides and a large window in each face, was built to mimic the pilot house of a riverboat. It was actually moved from Quarry Farm to the Elmira College campus for preservation in 1952.
This side and the other side, you'll see these little holes that now have the grates over them. Those were the cat doors. He absolutely loved cats and their company when he was writing in this building. I have a key to it now. I don't imagine he had to have a key in the 1800s. Probably know he smoked a lot. I don't know. He's averaged between 30 and 40 cigars a day. You got to think of smoke and cats and lots of paper and breezes coming through.
After dinner each summer night, Twain would sit in the rocking chair on the porch at Quarry Farm, looking out at the Chemung River, and read the manuscript pages he wrote that day out loud to his wife and daughters.
Once or twice a night, we'd see a steamboat slipping along in the dark, and every now and again, she'd belch a whole world of sparks up out of her chimney, and they would rain down in the river and look awful pretty.
His life in Elmira was far different from his youth in a Missouri river town. His father died when he was just 11, and Twain hit the road, working a variety of jobs. He traveled across the country and to Hawaii, Europe, and the Middle East. But in Elmira, Twain found something he never had, a stable family environment. Scholar Michael Kiskis.
He'd been such a vagabond for the years between 17 and 30 that this gave him a real chance to put down roots and to be kind of hugged by a big family, and I think he really appreciated that. If you look at the major novels through the major kind of frame of his career, look how many of them deal with questions of family.
For Mark Twain, Elmira represented family and the end of family. Twain is buried on a hill at Woodlawn Cemetery here, along with his wife, all his children, and his only grandchild, who had no children. The gravestones tell a sad story. His son Langdon died as an infant. His daughter Susie died when she was 24 of spinal meningitis. His wife died when she was 58. And his daughter Jean, an epileptic, died at age 29 when she drowned in her bathtub on Christmas Eve. Barb Snedeker.
You know, he just cannot comprehend that. He refuses to come to Elmira to see her buried here. He says he doesn't want to see another family member laid in the dirt.
Mark Twain stopped spending summers in Elmira after his daughter Susie's death in 1896. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
Efforts to forge a bipartisan plan to rein in the federal deficit are reaching a critical stage. Today, the co-chairman of President Obama's Budget Commission, former Republican Senator Alan Simpson, and President Clinton's former Chief of Staff, Erskine Bowles, said they are delaying a vote on their plan until Friday. The vote was supposed to have happened tomorrow. During a news conference this afternoon, Bowles said no matter what happens with the vote, the commission has achieved a lot.
Al and I couldn't be happier with where we are in the process, regardless of how the vote turns out. I think we've won, and we've won big. The era of deficit denial in Washington is over.
That's what Erskine Bowles said. NPR economics correspondent John Itzde has been following developments and joins us now. So, John, why the delay in the vote?
Well, the chairman have been scrambling to line up votes, and the deadline set by the president's executive order came just a little too early to finish things up. That's partly because a plan that the co-chairman unveiled a couple of weeks ago took a lot of flack from both the left and the right. They modified it over Thanksgiving and have been meeting individually with members of the commission in the past couple of days, trying to drum up support. They haven't had time to put all of the adjustments they've made into print. They hope to have a version sometime tonight or early tomorrow morning that they'll give to commission members. And then the commission will meet in public tomorrow to discuss it. But the chairman decided they wanted to wait for a vote until Friday.
But these changes to the original plan that Simpson and Bowles put out, do we know what the changes are?
No, the chairman wouldn't reveal the changes today, but Erskine Bowles did say this.
The plan we submit tomorrow, you've asked about the differences. It's not going to be some watered-down version of a chairman's mark. That I can guarantee you.
And a chairman's mark is Washington language, of course, for a chairman's proposal. And the original chairman's proposal that Bowles and Simpson put on the table was very controversial. It would have cut projected deficits by $3.8 trillion over the next 9 years. That would have been done with a combination of cuts in defense spending, cuts in Social Security benefits for high-income people, controlling expenditures in Medicare and Medicaid. Also, there would have been equally controversial tax increases, including eliminating the deduction of mortgage interest. So if it's not going to be watered down, the modified proposal is likely to be
still very controversial.
Right.
Now, as we've reported before, this commission, it's bipartisan. It has 18 members, and the president's executive order says that the plan, that it, assuming there is a plan, needs to get 14 of those 18 votes for the plan to be approved. Does that appear likely right now?
No, I think it's unlikely they'll get 14 votes. But that specific number is less significant now than it was when the commission was formed. You may remember that House Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Reid had pledged that if the commission's plan got 14 votes from the 18 members of the panel, it would trigger a vote on the deficit reduction proposal in Congress. Right. Of course, the new Congress will have a new Republican speaker next year who's not bound by Pelosi's pledge, so the number 14 becomes less meaningful. So I think it's more important that the co-chairman get 9 or 10 votes, including both Democrats and Republican, to back the plan. That way it could become the basis for a congressional
plan. So I asked for 14. We don't have 14. How about 9 or 10? Is that possible?
Well, there's still a lot of doubt about that. Although, on the other hand, one very experienced hand at this stuff, Alice Rivlin, who participated in deals that actually helped balance the budget back in the 1990s, says she's optimistic the commission can move the ball forward.
Okay, thank you, John.
You're welcome.
NPR economics correspondent John Itzde.
The United Nations climate treaty talks are back in session. This year, diplomats chose a tropical climate for their meeting place. They're in Cancun, in Mexico. Last year's meetings were in snowy Copenhagen. And it's not just the weather that has changed here. Diplomats are taking a less ambitious approach this time. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The climate talks in Copenhagen attracted many world leaders, including President Obama. The goal was to create a global regime to hold carbon dioxide emissions in check to slow global warming. But the meeting was fractious and ended without a strong agreement. Still, there is momentum, particularly from Europe, to use the United Nations process to take on this global issue. And Salim Al-Haq from the International Institute for Environment and Development in London says people are hoping to use the meeting in Cancun to regroup.
People are lowering expectations so that we get something out of it. I think the approach that we had last year in Copenhagen, where it was a sort of all-or-nothing approach, blew up in our faces and we got nothing out of it.
Cancun could possibly put some flesh on the bones of a non-binding accord that came out of Copenhagen. The U.S., China, India, and other major players signed on to long-term voluntary emissions reductions. But it wasn't formally adopted by the United Nations. Jennifer Morgan at the World Resources Institute says it was big on concepts, short on details, for example, financing.
The accord said, let's start a fund, but it was just a few sentences. What kind of fund? Hopefully in Cancun they can decide as a UN to start a fund and how they're actually going to get it up and running.
In fact, financing is the one area where there could be progress in Cancun. Earlier this fall, the United Nations pulled together a committee to figure out how the rich nations of the world could raise $100 billion a year to help the poor countries adapt to climate change. Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg co-chaired that committee. In an interview with NPR, he said they tried to figure out how economic development and climate protection could move forward hand in hand.
One way of obtaining that is, of course, to make sure that the economic growth in the developing world is cleaner, not as polluting as the economic growth has been in the developed world. And that's one of the reasons why we focus so much on financing.
Stoltenberg's committee concluded the world needs to put a price on carbon emissions in order to raise money for the developing world. That's admittedly a tough sell, at least in the short run, in this global economic climate.
It's unrealistic to believe that the meeting in Cancun can agree on all the different proposals, recommendations we have in our report. But hopefully Cancun can agree how to move forward. Finance is a key also because it creates the climate of trust between developing and developed countries.
One perennial issue is how third world nations would spend the money that rich nations have pledged. Salim Al-Haq argues that his home country, Bangladesh, is actually setting a good example. This low-lying nation has drawn up plans for how it would cope with rising sea levels, which are expected as a result of global warming.
And it includes a variety of things from dredging the rivers to prevent overflowing and flooding, investing in agriculture, new crops, new rice varieties that can be grown in the coastal areas with increasing salinity. And they've actually made quite a lot of progress on this.
Huck is also guardedly optimistic that diplomats can make incremental progress in Cancun to limit deforestation, which is a key element of coping with climate change. But don't expect big progress on the core of the climate treaty, and that is measures to slow emissions from the world's biggest emitters, China and the United States. China has shown no interest in making legally binding promises in that regard, and in the wake of the U.S. elections, there is essentially no prospect now for aggressive climate legislation here. Still, Jennifer Morgan says she'd like to hear President Obama reiterate the pledge he made in Copenhagen, enacting policies that would reduce our nation's emissions by 17% in the next decade.
Without that, it's awfully hard for others to trust that the U.S. is really serious about doing anything about global warming. And that makes a success in Cancun a pretty hard thing to imagine.
The meeting runs through mid-December. Richard Harris, NPR News.